All right, everybody, welcome back. I'm Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly High Performance Human podcast. Hey, listen, I'm pretty certain in the last few months you've come to value your health and fitness as much as I have. Personally, for the last few years, I've been slowly adjusting my approach, not just in the way I conduct my own training, but the way in which I coach other people. And it's one where health and human performance has come before race fitness. Now, the two are inextricably linked, but what I've become more aware of is how good performance cannot exist without good health. And the whole coronavirus outbreaks just reinforce this belief. In 2020, we might have had our racing interrupted, or it might have been erased completely, but that's not stopped us, has it? We've carried on. I know for sure that many of you found new ways to stay active, and hopefully, like me, you've started to enjoy the process and discipline of daily exercise, and that have given you new purpose. That's not to say we won't embrace the opportunity to race when we get the chance, but I think when events like COVID-19 challenge our health and enjoyment, we start to realise what is truly important. In future podcasts, I'll be sticking occasionally to the triathlon theme, but more importantly, I'll be looking at this whole subject of the high performance human, and I hope you enjoy the new lens which we're looking through. And it will definitely be my goal and my pleasure to share information which will educate you and enable you to achieve your potential as a human being first and then an athlete, and help you to create the foundation to be the best version of yourself, whether that's triathlon, ultra running, cycling, open water swimming, whatever you like. Human first, then athletic performance. Anyway, enough of what's coming up in the future. Let's get back to the present and crack on with today's guest. Welcome back, folks. Well, I'm excited today. We've got another of our transatlantic guests on. And if you are a cycle aficionado, particularly a bike aficionado, and you are a triathlete, you can't fail to have heard of Cervelo bikes. You've probably even got one yourself. They're definitely the most popular bikes. If you go to the bike count at the Hawaii Ironman, they're probably the ones you see in most abundance when you go to check in the transitions like I do when I'm commentating. So it's a real pleasure to have onto the show tonight the co-founder of Cervelo Bikes, Mr. Phil White. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
So Phil also has just he's left Cervelo Bikes now, I think I'm right in saying, completely?
Yep, I'm completely out. So we sold the company in 2012. Stayed on for a few years as the director of innovation for all their bike brands. And then I guess 3 years ago, left that. So, yep, completely out now.
But recently you have taken on the role as acting president at 4i. So we'll come on to that later and you can tell us all about what 4i do. But I'm most familiar with them for power meters.
Yeah, they're probably best known for that. We're sponsoring ISN right now, so it's really Startup Nation team. So very well known for that, as well as obviously a fair number of triathletes. But I mean, they make far more than that. They got their start really, I think, probably best known in heart rate monitors and also in smart trainers. So kind of three areas, but it's sport electronics.
Okay, well, we'll come back onto that towards the end then. As my guests should know by now, no coach likes to get started on a session without a warm-up. So I've sent you a few questions. Hopefully, I haven't put you on the spot, but you've had an exciting life, Phil. You've taken a company from a startup to one of the major brands in the world. So that's a big ride. If somebody decided they were going to make a film of that life and that story, who would you want to play you in the leading role?
Well, that's kind of, I don't know, like, what is, you did kind of catch me by surprise on these ones. I saw them like just moments ago. So, I'm a big fan of Johnny Depp, but I'm not sure that I'm Johnny Depp. I mean, does that, because I like him as an actor, doesn't mean that he'd be good at playing me. I really don't know. That's a good one.
Yeah, I don't reckon.
Maybe Brad Pitt. I mean, because every woman wants Brad Pitt, so maybe I want to be Brad Pitt. Although my wife has given me the evil eye now, so maybe not.
Okay, Johnny Depp or Brad Pitt. I'll have to go and have a look on the internet and have a look at some Johnny Depp pictures. He's definitely got the same color hair as you, and he's had a mustache in various guises, hasn't he? When he was
that's true, yeah.
Pirates Captain Jack Sprat.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe that's a good choice. In films, actors tend to have superpowers. I ask this one a lot, and we get one common answer. I'd be interested to know what yours was. If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Yeah. Whew. I don't know. What would it be? You know, I used to think that when I was younger that it'd be great not to have to sleep, because it'd give you so much time to extra to get anything done. But as I've got older, I haven't needed to sleep as much, you know, when I'm not working out all the time especially. And I found it actually, it's really not fun. So I'm going to respond with saying that actually the one thing I wouldn't want to have is to not have to sleep. And I do have a friend that doesn't sleep hardly at all.
Really?
This is horrible, and I back that up. Not sleeping is not a is a negative superpower.
Maybe your superpower would be to sleep at will.
Yeah.
Does your friend that doesn't sleep, is that by choice that he doesn't sleep? I mean, I have heard Tim Ferriss wrote in his book about sleeping and about experimenting with polyphasic sleeping, where you get this sort of 15 minutes every 2 to 3 hours, which is supposed to be the super way to sleep, but it's not particularly sociable and it doesn't really fit in with the rest of everybody's lives.
This guy that I know that has the problem with it, it's a problem. So it's a medical thing. But he doesn't, you know, fall asleep during the day. He just doesn't need that to sleep much. And he doesn't sleep much. Mm. And so he doesn't like it. Yeah, it's for sure.
I love sleeping, and I find it the most frustrating thing in the world when I can't get to sleep, and particularly if you're lying there awake and others are asleep in the same room.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Horrible. We once went to do a triathlon in Norway, and because of some last-minute complications with our accommodation, we ended up about 6 to a room with all these beds there and people sleeping on the floor. And we had to start at, I think we had to get up at 3 a.m., so everybody else decided they wanted to go to bed at 8. I can't go to sleep at that time. So I just lay there trying not to make a sound. And, you know, one by one, I could hear them all snoring and breathing deeply. And I was, it was frustrating. Do you read many books, Phil? I can see on your bookshelf. It's been a big pastime of the newscasters in Britain these days, when they are doing Zoom interviews to make comment on people's bookshelves. What about you?
Yeah,
there's up there.
There's quite a few things up there, but they're mostly technical books. There's Bicycling Science over there, but there's a whole bunch of books on theory of wing sections and aerodynamics and all sorts of things like that. I'd have to say, though, to be politically correct, that my wife's book on To Make Riders Faster, by far the best book I've ever read. So that's a good one. Actually, it is a really good book. I mean, it was... before she started, she wanted to write the history of Cervelo, and she asked Gerard and I, and our feeling was, well, don't just make it like just gloss over the hard times and the mistakes we made, like make it so that people actually learn something from it. So she did that. And I think she's been pretty honest and forthright about the things we screwed up as well. I just say, arguably learn more from your mistakes than your successes. I don't think it's even arguable. You definitely learn more from your mistakes, and hopefully you can learn from some of our mistakes and not repeat them. And there were a fair number of them, so there's a lot to learn there.
I did have a look around the internet for that book. There weren't many previews, although there were some good write-ups that I looked at. Seems to get a good review as a coffee table book. Did I catch you saying that it was your wife that wrote that book then?
Yes. Yeah.
Because she must. Does she use her maiden name then for that? Because she doesn't use the surname White, does she?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
So yeah, she was there for quite a long time at Cervelo. So she was in the mix. I knew all the warts and all the problems. You can get it online at tomakeridersfaster.com. So there you go. There's a plug.
Well, we'll put a link to that on the show notes for those people who want to go and get it. And what I'll do is I'll see if I can link to a couple of the reviews as well. We were talking before the show. Dan Empfield did quite a nice review on it on Slow Twitch. As we said in our pre-conversation, Dan's probably got a bit of empathy with you in the situation, because he was at Quinn. You know, he he started up and sold Quintana Roo, didn't he? And probably went through some of those same issues that you were chatting about and made some of those same mistakes.
Yep, I'm sure.
Well, you talked about mistakes there, Phil. If you could change anything in your past, is there anything that you would go back and change, or do you believe that all of those things are there for a reason and you wouldn't change them?
Well, I'm not sure they're all there for a reason other than to, you learn something from it, from everything. So, but looking back, I would have got into the bike industry sooner. It's, it's super fun industry, kind of crazy, maybe a lot crazy. But the people are fantastic. Everyone's really, gung-ho on it. Everyone's putting a lot into it. You don't do it because you want to make a lot of money. That's not a reason to go into the bike industry. But it is dynamic. There's a lot of going on. People are fantastic. I mean, that's been really, really fun. So, and you're making something that's really good for society. So, one thing, when we sold the Pond, I spent a lot more time working on city bikes and that sort of thing rather than the high performance. And I love high performance. I mean, I used to race cars, still do race cars a bit. And I love that aspect of dialing in the performance and making it better. But the idea of like actually overall helping society and how do you move people? I mean, you can argue that, well, climate change is probably the biggest existential threat we face, but man, congestion in cities is just a horrendous mess and waste of people's time. So bikes are a big solution to both those problems. And it's fun to work on solving those problems.
There's been a lot of talk in the UK. I don't know if there's been the same in Canada about how the streets have almost been reclaimed during lockdown in the cities, and a lot of the main cities now are closing down some of the arterial routes or narrowing the driving lanes and putting in temporary bike lanes with a view to obviously monitoring those and deciding whether they're going to make them more permanent. It always intrigues me the resistance you get from car drivers, because they say that cyclists are a menace, and yet if all of those cyclists decided to drive cars, surely that would make the life more difficult for those people who still choose to drive, because there'd be more of them.
Yeah, I've had the same thing. It's like, I think some of them they're getting better. I mean, Europe's always been significantly farther ahead of North America, but North Americans are getting better and they're realizing that, hey, I'd rather have a cyclist where I know where they are. I know they're always behind in those lanes. They're not going to be weaving in front of me, or, I'm not going to turn into them. So, cyclists and car drivers love, segregated lanes. So I think now you're seeing more and more people go, yeah, I'd be much rather have them over there and going their own way and not blocking me in traffic. And also, I mean, you're another 20 feet closer to your objective at least, because there's one guy on a bike. So one guy on a bike taking not the 20 feet, which is really probably more like 60 or 80 feet in front of you. So, yeah.
The biggest argument you see in this country is that motorists pay a road tax. Used to be called a road tax for your car. It's called something else now. And how much you pay depends on the emissions. And cyclists don't pay any sort of fee to ride on the road. So although most of them are motorists, and so they will be paying in other ways. And of course, all of those people who have bikes will be contributing towards the upkeep of the roads through the tax that they pay from their earnings. But that's also the biggest gripe, is that cyclists should be paying to ride on the road. You know, I pay my road fund license or my vehicle excise license or whatever they call it. You know, those cyclists ride in there for free. Again, forgetting that most of those cyclists actually have a car and that's the day they choose not to. Maybe they should be getting a rebate.
Yeah, the same thing here. And one thing that there have been a couple of studies that show that, that the roads are super heavily subsidized. Like your gas taxes don't by any means cover the cost of all the road construction. So, you're taxing, actually unfairly taxing a cyclist out of, their general tax to pay for roads that are used by cars principally. And the cost of building a cycle lane or a cycle track next to the road is, one 100th the cost per linear mile that it is for a roadway, because you don't need 4 feet of concrete and then 2 feet of asphalt on top of that. You need some gravel and 2 inches of asphalt. I mean, it costs nothing. It can be installed super fast, and they're nowhere near as wide. They're only, you know, a couple of meters wide. So yeah, people forget that. But if we, you know, if we started having everyone ride, we wouldn't need all that expensive motorway and other infrastructure.
Well, and that would have so many other benefits, wouldn't it, on the environment, but also on people's health. Because, you know, I mean, where I live, I'm not really in the city. I'm not in the country. I'm sort of in the middle. You know, but some of the roads near me are some of the most heavily densely populated with cars in the north of England. And at certain times when there's not much wind and it's quite warm, you can feel the pollution in the air. You know, you can feel it in your throat. And I don't have any breathing difficulties, but I guess if I had asthma, I'd notice it more. So if more people were riding, it just seems to have exponential benefits for everybody.
Oh yeah. Like, I mean, you look at the stats, I think the WHO releases stats on the number of people killed in different city or different countries by pollution. It's really high. It's the unseen killer. It's the uncounted killer. People don't count it. Like, the person died from a lung infection or something. Well, they got that because they were breathing toxic fumes out of the back of a car for all the time. So yeah, totally with you.
I can see how that sort of project to get the masses to ride and making bikes that are easy for them to ride and control, and maybe some of the Boris bikes or the electric bikes that are coming out now that you know, you can just you'll have your little app on your phone and you go and tap it and go and ride it and then deposit it. You know, we tried some of those in Spain and they're fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the one thing we're finding here in North America as well, is because things are generally quite a bit farther apart than they are in Europe, and people are less cycling savvy. So, I mean, the two go together mean that the rate of adoption for cycling and commuting and moving around has been much lower. But the e-bike offers a lot of opportunities there. My beef with e-bikes is that we just have to make them so they're easier to use, because people get on it, and, you know, if you get in your car, you just get in the car, you push the button or turn the key, and then, you know, you just put it in drive and away you go. And, you know, a bike is more complex. It's like, you know, you've got all these gears to shift. And I used to think that was just a North American thing, that we didn't actually like to shift gears because everything's an automatic. But actually, one of the things that I did when I was with Pond is we just sat there and we'd watch people in Amsterdam. And, you know, they would do the same as we do in North America. They have like 6 gears or whatever, 8 gears. And they would arrive at the stoplight in one gear and they'd leave in exactly the same gear. They're grinding away to get out of it. It's like, so you can put 8, 10, 12 gears on a bike, but people use one of them. So we've got to make it so that it's just intuitive and simple, and they don't have to learn to shift gears, and especially chain rings. I mean, that's just, you know, how difficult that is. So people just don't deal with that. So if we make it easier and much more convenient, people will ride more, I think.
Well, that's something I'd like to come back to later, Phil, actually, is, you know, when I look at bikes now, I think, what else can they do with bikes, particularly the bikes that I ride and our listeners ride, you know, the triathlon type bikes and the sort of high performance road bikes. What more that can they do to improve bicycling? But I guess there's also an awful lot, bearing in mind what you just said about the use of gears and the complexity of those, that we could do to make the majority of those riders feel more comfortable on them. So maybe we can come back to that in terms of bicycling innovation. Let's finish your warm up. I've got a couple more questions for you. You've no doubt been exposed to some fantastic minds and brains and thinkers during your sort of history with Cervelo and probably before then. Is there anybody that you would choose to mentor you for 1 month, dead or alive? And if so, why? Why would you choose them?
I don't know. Is it like, I really enjoy reading and taking input from a lot of different people. So, I think that, you know, maybe like, I'll just give you a quote from JFK. Leadership is learnership. And that's not because I'm a huge JFK fan, although I certainly am a fan. But, I mean, you're always learning. So there's so many areas you can learn from. You know, they say that, you know, one thing that senior executives have is, you know, one of the lessons is have a coach. And you think, well, why does the guy at the top of a company need a coach? Well, because everyone needs a coach, and I'm speaking to a coach. So yeah, there's a plug for you. Everybody needs a coach. And, you know, that was one thing that I find now, that because I'm in at Four Eyes, and you know, I came from the board, and the board still kind of monitors me and mentors me. So it's like, you know, it should be a good relationship where you go back and they say, well, have you thought about this? Or what about that? And you go, I hadn't thought of that way of looking at it. So, I mean, I think talking to other people and eliciting their opinions, even if you know they're different than your opinion, it just forces you to understand why you've got that opinion, and maybe you should be looking at changing it, or maybe it just reinforces your opinion. But more opinions and more diverse opinions is always good. So yeah, I don't have one person that I would do that, but you should always be learning and listening.
So it sounds like you'd rather have 30 mentors for one day each.
Yeah, I'll go with that. That's a good solution. Just don't ask me for the list of 30.
Yeah, exactly. That might take us to the end of this podcast. I guess when you were at Cervelo, did you used to visit the races and go and watch the bikes in action? Was that something you were keen on?
Yeah, it was one thing that's how we started, because Jordan and I, when we got involved, we weren't, like, people used to ask us, are you guys ex-pros or something? No, we're not ex-pros. We're just engineers that thought we could build a better bike. And the way we did that was by listening to the customer and watching the customer. And so we didn't have any preconceived notions of what was the right way to do it, other than the science behind it. And we carried that through. I think that was one of our strengths, is that we would watch people, and we go to a lot of races. And it was, even in the early days, that was how you sold things. That was your advertising. You know, you made 1,000 leaflets and you stuck them in every person's windscreen wipe or windshield wiper at every race. You know, that was your marketing. And you went into the demo areas and in the things, and you put up your tent and you talk to people. So it was absolutely the way we started. We did a lot of driving in those early days. Gerard actually did his first. Gerard didn't have his license when we first met. Being Dutch, he rode everywhere. He went home and got his license after a year or so. And he came back, and the first drive he did was from Toronto to LA. So wow. He had to go out for a race out there. And so yeah, we did a lot of driving to go to different races.
So in all of the places you've been and all the stuff you've done in your life, is there what's left on that list of things you'd like to accomplish or to go and visit?
Oh, man. I spent a lot of time in Asia. Funny story. I went over there for the bike show, a Taipei bike show, 1 year. I thought I was packed for 2 weeks, and we were having some problems, and we were making things in Taiwan. And yeah, I came back 4 months later. So it's just like, but it was a start of an ongoing, spending a lot of time in Asia. So it started in Taiwan, and then it went beyond that. And, you know, we spent, had an apartment in Taiwan, then moved over to China and had an apartment there for a while. And then kind of moved back here. But, one thing I never did is I never really got to spend time being a tourist in Asia. I never went to Cambodia or Vietnam and did the tourist things. I didn't, and even in China, I didn't really have a chance to do a lot, although I did, a little bit to at least have fun. So I like going to totally different places. I definitely want to go to Angkor Wat and some of the Vietnam area. I just have friends that have just loved it there. Thailand is absolutely stunning. I've been there quite a few times, and we had a really good distributor there. So he used to organize rides for us, well outside the city. So he'd spend some time riding in the country. Fantastic place to ride. I mean, stinking hot, but super fun. So yeah, I'd like to do more time in Asia, because I haven't seen enough of Asia.
Okay. Maybe you're getting some 4i stuff done out there, I guess, as a way.
And the distributor focus for next year is, what do you know? It's Asia.
Okay, let's have some quick fire things then. You afraid of anything? Do you have any fears?
I'm afraid of doing a crappy job. So it's like, I love pushing the limits, making really good stuff, and I'm afraid of not doing good work.
Does that is that um a trait of engineers, do you think?
I don't know. I don't know whether it's engineers or just a cultural thing. I mean, some people are fine just doing a job. I've got to do the best job possible. I want to make a really, you know, I want to make, it's a politically incorrect maybe, but a cool shit that matters. So, you know, making cool stuff that really makes a difference. It's not the Me Too thing. That's what really motivates me.
I saw in one of the, when I was doing my research, I saw in, perhaps it was something from the book actually, about when you were building one of the Cervelo frames, you were arguing about with the engineers about whether you should have an ovalized or a normal head tube.
Oh yeah, that was, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, it's not always just about performance. It's about how do you get people on board. Sometimes you need to take people down a journey. It's not a matter of, you know, taking them to the end state immediately. They've got to work their way through that to get to the end state. So that was one of those discussions is, you know, what, you know, we wanted to make a bike that was, you know, super aero, but in the early days, people didn't want aero bikes. So it was like, okay, so we can make an aero bike, but how aero should it be? How much should it look and carry the design language of a traditional bike? And those are, you know, there's no right answer to that. It's, you know, it's a matter of like your judgment on the acceptability by customers. So that's a challenge. That's a designer's challenge. I mean, that's not an engineering challenge. It's a designer's challenge. And to me, a good engineer has to be a good designer. They have to understand those cultural aspects of the thing they're building as well.
Just going off topic a little bit here. I read a book called, I can't remember the name of the guy who wrote it, but he was one of the senior executives at General Motors, and he wrote a book called Car Guys versus the Bean Counters. And it was all about how they had these fantastically designed cars at GM in the 60s, early 60s, but the accountants were saying, look, we're not making enough money. And if we've got this model here, we could actually press the panels from that or use the doors from that one on this one here. And so we could get economies of scale. And so the design started to be evolved by the guys who were counting the cash rather than the designers. And the designers were really superfluous. They were really having to make these things fit instead of making things look good. And so General Motors started to produce horrible looking cars at the end of the 60s. And of course, the performance started to go down as well. And it was a GM Lutz, Bob Lutz, I think was his name actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you've not read the book, it's a fantastic insight into the battle between, you know, the passion of the designers and the guys who count the cash.
Yeah. That never stops. I mean, that was the reason the Aztec, I don't know if you guys are in Europe ever saw that, but it was a horrible looking vehicle. But it started out as actually a pretty innovative, cool vehicle. But then the bean counters got at it and they said, well, why don't we really don't use this existing platform? And why don't you use those wheels? And why don't you use this interior? And it started to just look like it was a car designed by committee and it looked like just an abomination. So
yeah,
classic. So that's, you know, that is the nice thing about when Gerard and I had Cervelo is because we just did what we wanted to do. We wanted to make cool bikes that really mattered, that were, you know, that were different and were better. And so we just did, it was never a question for us. We just did it. And then, you know, you talk to other people and they go, how did you guys do that? It just became part of the culture. It's like, it was funny because you know when your culture is strong, when people repeat it back to you, because we started off with the mission of to make riders faster, which is Anna's book's name, of course. But then we kind of made it, we wanted to make it more inclusive and massaged it. And we changed it a bit from that. But people would still come back to it in meetings and that and say, well, why are we doing this? And they'd say, well, we're doing it to make riders faster. And so the whole thing was that was the mission statement and the vision that just resonated with the employees and the employees adopted. Didn't matter whether we wanted to change it. They'd adopted that. And that was the culture of the company.
My next question was, what's your favorite motto? Would that be, you know, to make riders faster? Would that be your favorite motto?
Well, I think it's the favorite, it's the motto for Cervelo, but you know, I don't think that's, you know, in life, I don't know what it would be. Well, there's a good, the Special Air Service, since we're talking British here, Special Air Service motto of those who risk win.
Who dares wins, I think it is.
Yeah, who dares wins. So,
who dares wins, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a great one.
Yeah. Mm, that's interesting. That'll come around to one of the questions I've got for you later, actually, about your time at Cervelo. I was also going to mention there, as you talked about, to make riders go faster, I did some presenting with a guy called Ben Hunt Davis. He was a member of the British Rowing Eight that won a gold medal at the Sydney Olympics, not been done by the British Eight for over 100 years. The premise of the book is that 2 years before the Olympics, they weren't even going to make it. Their ranking was seventh, so they wouldn't even get into the final. They'd be in that sort of B final. And so they just said, well, what's the point in going to the Olympics if we know we're not even going to get into the final? So we need to do everything next year to make sure we get selected and to make sure we get into the A final to get us a chance of a medal. And they came up with this motto, will it make the boat go faster? So they would come up with everything. They would look at design. They would probably speak to people, you know, or your peers in the boat design industry. They would speak to aerodynamicists. They would speak to physiotherapists and nutritionists and exercise physiologists. They talked to people who made the kit, hydrodynamicists, everybody that could add something, you know, almost like the marginal gains. And when they would have their little committee, they even moved in together. So they all lived together. So they were under the same roof. So they didn't have to travel to training. And every time they had a committee and somebody would come up with an idea, this question would come up, will it make the boat go faster? And he actually has a business consultancy based on that now. And he uses those same principles in industries. You know, will it make the company go better? Or will it make the bike go faster? Will it make the rider go faster? A very interesting book. More of there's a lot of anecdotes there from his rowing days, but there's a lot of business stuff as well. You'd definitely be interested in it, I'm sure.
That's cool. I'll check that out. It's very much the philosophy of like Dan Bigham and the guys on that team. You know, it's funny. Like I've had quite a few chats with Dan. I really like his focus, and it's like. I did some work for some contract work for some other the Olympic teams. And I mean, you can break everything down. So, you know, okay, everything down is like, what is that going to cost you a watt or gain you a watt? And when you do it that way, everyone gets focused because the metric for comparison is watts. And so do you think that's a good idea? And when everyone thinks an idea is a good idea, I mean, you say, hey, just convert it to watts. And if you can prove it's going to make us faster, do it. And it became very easy because everyone knew what the basis of comparison was. You could propose something, but the first question was, how many watts does it save? And I think Dan's done a phenomenal job of that with his team, and obviously went over to work with the Danes and done a spectacular job there as well.
Interesting. That's one of the reasons why Great Britain Cycling were able to predict with such accuracy how many medals they were going to win it, you know, when they were in there sort of right at the peak, you know, 2008 and 2012, because you know what the air pressure is going to be like in the velodrome, you know what the weight of the riders is, you know what the resistance of the, you know, the tires is going to be, and all of that stuff within the velodrome and on the boards, you know what the critical power of each athlete is, and so you can have a pretty good idea of what specific time is going to win you a gold medal and work towards that, reverse engineer it. It's a little bit different in triathlon. I know people try to do it and do all that marginal gain stuff, but it's not quite as easy when you've got three sports and you've got the weather and, you know, the water and other athletes to take into account.
Which is what makes triathlon so interesting, is because it's, you can't just reduce it down to, you know, a kilo. You know, in a very controlled environment. I mean, it's the same thing they've done with baseball. Baseball, the environment is so controlled that you can take it down to a matter of, you know, formulas and algorithms. But yeah, many sports don't conform to that, and triathlon is definitely one of them. I mean, you look at the progress we've made in bikes, and still, you know, you're not seeing massive gains on the bike leg. Why is that? I mean, there's a lot of theories on it, but it's quite an interesting discussion and to watch, you know, what's happening.
Maybe we should go down that discussion then. What do you think the reasons are then?
I think it's a balance of those things, and I haven't run the data on it. So, but I would imagine that, you know, people are managing all three legs together, and the weather is massive impact. So, yeah, you've been there, so you know what, it can totally change things. And then you go into the energy lab, and it doesn't matter what's happened before then. I think it's a matter of how the interplay and your training goes in all three of those legs. So I think also there's a lot of things. I've been working with some people recently on the effect of gusts, and everyone likes to look at it as a nice steady wind, but of course, especially on the Queen K, it's not a steady wind. You get these gusts, and if you can't stay in your air position, well, it doesn't matter what your numbers were. If you're out of the air position, you're in trouble. Mm. And then, I mean, even if you're in the air position, but you're fighting the bike all the time, there's been some pretty good, there's been a few studies I've seen on the effect of, you know, tensing up and being, you know, not being able to deliver power to the pedal because you're tensing other muscle groups to try and keep the bike stable. And you can't measure that in a wind tunnel. It doesn't measure. So how do we deal with this issue of gusts? And like the newer generation of wheels are less gust sensitive from just anecdotal evidence. You probably felt that as well. But I still think that there's a way to go to make them, you know, so they actually work all the time in all wind conditions. How do you take into account that? I've been working with some people that are trying to figure that out. That's a very interesting question that I think doesn't show up in the current numbers.
You, riding down from Harvey, down that stretch of road where it gets quite open and you get the wind coming in from the sea. So the wind is coming in from your right. I've ridden down there and seen particularly the smaller females who are riding deeper rim wheels go from the shoulder to the middle of the road in one gust, you know, and you're looking at it and thinking, well, how did they get there? It's just like something lifts them up. Firstly, I don't know why they insist on riding such deep rim wheels when they haven't got the body weight to carry off. You know, it's okay for the bigger guys, but I'd just always think, you know, I'd be going for caution there rather than ultimate speed, because it's a riskier game if you get one gust too many.
Yeah.
But what you say there is quite interesting in terms of riding style as well. Is if you look at Lionel Sanders, he always looks like he's trying to bend that bike in half when he's riding it. He puts so much power into it, which he has. But I can't help but looking at him riding and think, man, if you could just suppress that a little bit, you know, like some of the best tour riders when they can ride fast but without any body movement. I just wonder then how much of that energy he could use for the run, and particularly in the latter stages of the run. And that is the puzzle, isn't it, for triathlon? It's not just about the bike. It's how can you go fast on the bike and do it without burning too many matches?
Yeah, totally.
No doubt we could carry on that discussion right through this podcast, Phil, but we've got a lot of other stuff to cover. When you and Gerard started at Cervelo, I read that you were always determined to be meaningfully better than your competitors and to tell people about it in an authentic way. So you spent a lot of time then in the mid-90s on the forums, because we didn't have Facebook, you know, we didn't have podcasts really. I'm not trying to put you on the spot here, but coming on this podcast today, is that the modern version of you being sharing your authenticity and your passion for what you do and being able to get your message across to the customers? And do you find that a better way than being on the forums, or are you just utilizing more channels now?
I don't know. Yeah, we noticed that we were spending a fair bit of time on the forums, and so. It was a really good way to get feedback, especially initially, because, you know, that was the social media of the time. It worked just fine. I mean, you had this, is the forum on Slow Twitch any different than the rec bike or rec bike triathlon forum that was back then? It's like, no, it's the same thing. He doesn't have, we didn't have Facebook, but I mean, you know, a Facebook group is the same as Rec Sport Triathlon or Rec Bike Tech or anything like that. So you get the same things. It's just, you know, it was free back then, whereas now you're getting marketed to when you're on Facebook. So yeah, I think the nice thing about the podcasts and video casts is that it does allow you to spend a little more time in a more casual environment and discuss things back and forth. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, you can have a you have a different persona just by nature of the fact that it's text-based. So it's compressed and more structured. So yeah, I think this is just it's a way to talk authentically about what you're doing, and people ask questions. So you always want to have a two-way conversation. You always, like, I always learn something from these conversations as well. So, you know, it's not just a broadcast media, like, it's an engagement media. And the, you know, Seth Godin was really big about that. It's like, how do you have it so that it's a conversation? It's not just broadcast. Mm.
Yeah. That's an interesting thing, because, you know, this is a conversation, but it is just a conversation between me and you, and that people listening into those. We've experimented with people writing, letting people know beforehand who we have on as guests and asking them to write in. I'm looking at the idea of having a whole panel of people to come on and sit and perhaps like be an audience on Zoom while we're chatting, and then maybe have a live Q&A at the end, which would be an interesting concept.
I think that works pretty well, especially because I've done a few things like that where people can type in their thing and there's a moderator that goes and, you know, because you'll get probably the same question from a bunch of people, and but they can just kind of synthesize them down and give you a bunch at the end there, because it works pretty well.
I said right at the beginning in the introduction that you are by far and away the most populous bike at Ironman when Dan and the Slow Twitch people do their bike surveys. Did you ever have any interest or thought about dominating triathlon when you started out, or were you really aiming yourself at performance cycling?
Well, we started off aiming ourselves at performance cycling because we got a lot of help from Jenny Buño's team when we started. And it was only when we realized that, okay, these guys, how many bikes are they going to buy? Zero. It's like they have sponsors, and the sponsors weren't too interested in working with us because they said, you know, what we're trying to do is they're going to ride what we give them, even if it's not the fastest thing, because that's what we sell. So we're not interested in promoting anything else other than what we sell. So you kind of go, okay, so this isn't going to work. And a friend of mine was a top elite triathlete in Canada, was Ian Fraser. And so, he said, triathletes will ride anything because if it makes them faster. And that was the exact customer we wanted. It was people that would go out on a limb, try something new because it would make them faster. Because, cyclists, on the other hand, were very, very bound by tradition, bound by their teams, and they were really worried about not fitting in. So it's like, ooh, that's a weird looking bike. I don't want to be seen on that. People might think I'm not playing with the team, and I'm too trying to be different. And they didn't want to be different. Triathletes, by their very nature, were different, and they didn't care what it looked like. They would remember back in the mid-90s, and early 90s, there were some crazy looking stuff out there. Some of it was fast, some of it wasn't, but people would try it and find out. And so triathletes were the ultimate customer from that standpoint. And we just really embraced them because they would push us to constantly improve and make it better. And back then it was like, it was a really fun group of relatively small community. And so it started out going at, Steve had organized this thing at Texas A&M over New Year's every year. So he went down and they weren't using the facility in the wind tunnel, and a bunch of people would just go down and they'd try stuff in the tunnel. And then afterwards we'd leave there at night and go to Applebee's, which is a local restaurant, and everyone would trade info on what worked and what didn't. And so it was really fun. And there were no companies that when we started that, everyone was just doing it because they liked doing it. So you brung what you brung, packed your car with all these samples to take down and prototypes you'd made, and you throw them in the wind tunnel and everyone would see what it was. And that went on for probably, I was probably there 4 or 5 years. And then it slowly got commercial and people were locked out of doing it, and it became, people wanted more privacy, and it kind of dwindled away over a while. But it started out from the quest for making something better. And that was a fun group of people to be involved in.
Funny story for you. I mean, it's not just professional cyclists. Your average cyclist back in the 80s and 90s were very traditional. You know, they'd ride 50 miles to save 20 pence on an inner tube or something. And most of the old school guys are probably a bit like that, but certainly not the younger generation. I can remember I started out in triathlon in 1987. In 1989, Greg LeMond rode those time trial bars. Yeah. And he won the Tour de France on that final stage. And I had a pair of those bars. And I rode them to a local time trial. And a guy looked at me and he in his best Yorkshire accent, he said, "What's the doing with them silly things on the front of your bike?" And I said, "Well, they're aerodynamic. They're dangerous." I said, "Yeah, but they help you go faster. They're stupid and they're dangerous. You won't be able to use your brakes." I said, "But I'll be able to see if anybody's in front of me because I'll have my head up. I won't need my brakes." They won't catch on. A few weeks later, Greg LeMond rides them. And a few weeks later, I go to this time trial, say it's probably getting on to August now. And there's this same guy with a pair of these bars. And I said to him, "I thought you said they were stupid and dangerous." He said, "Aye, well, if you can't beat them, you've got to join them." and then the next year, everybody had them. But I can remember also one of the first times I got them. And these were the big, I think these are the DC bars that came almost like dropped handlebars. And then they came, and were they the ones that Boone Lennon, was it?
Boone Lennon did a lot of the work on those initially, yeah.
And I was riding my bike, you know, my normal road bike, but I put these things on, no bike fit or anything. So I was almost resting on top of them, and a pack of cyclists went the other way. And they were absolutely pointing at me and howling, you know, like I was some alien that had beamed down. But I guess most of them had the set by the year after, so I was just an early adopter. But that would have been the attitude of cyclists back then. Of course, it's totally different now.
Yeah, totally agree.
But yeah,
looking now, it's like when we started, there were every tour team was on a round tube Italian steel bike. Okay, there were maybe some few French and British Reynolds tube sets in there. But they were all round tube steel. Except one exception was like maybe a round tube aluminum bike. But you know, there was nothing aero. And now you look at it, and every team now is on a carbon aero bike. So yeah, it just took 25 years for them to kind of get with the program.
what about the bikes that Chris Boardman used, the Hotter and the Lotus bike? When did they come out?
When was it that Boardman? Yeah, because that was. Certainly, those were a huge step forward, and really set the world on edge. And those, you know, they were big times. I'm trying to remember what year it was with Boardman. I'm terrible on history, but it never really caught on. That was the problem. It was stuck in the, oh, it's a track thing. You know, it would never made it onto the road. And Trotham was quite much smaller at that point as well. And I think also they could have afforded it, because that was a nice thing about triathlon in the early days, is that their household income data was much better than for cyclists. So it was a good place to market to as well.
I looked at one of your early designs. I think it was the first bike that you designed, that Space Age Baracci, I saw it quoted as in 1995, looked very similar to the P5X. That came out sort of 20 years later. But going back before then, it would have been the early 2000s, I had a Soft Ride. Do you remember those, the beam bikes?
Oh, yeah, yep.
So that was a blade. It was polished aluminium, I think. It wasn't carbon fiber, but it did have a carbon, you had two types of carbon beam. You had the sort of very shallow S shape, and then they came out with a straight beam as well.
Yeah.
In polished aluminium. So that was a goofy looking bike, but I loved riding that. Really took away any back pain you got, because there was no vibration coming from the seat tube.
Yeah. Yeah. That's another thing too, is like it took a long time for cycling to understand the effect of vibration and how that affected your power output and your ability to just keep going longer, your endurance. So, you know, with bigger tires, I think that's obviously got better. Also grip overalls got better, because you run the tires at a lower pressure, so they actually, you don't wipe out going around corners as much. But yeah, like the that was a hard to measure, hard to quantify, benefit of all of those beam bikes, was they were more comfortable. If you didn't pedal smoothly, you maybe lost something in the bouncing, but if you pedaled smoothly, it was a significant reduction in the vibration.
Mm. I had my best runs getting off those, because of course your legs just felt a bit fresher.
Yeah.
So you became very popular in triathlon. And going back to the SAS motto, who dares wins. I mean, I know you said you were an engineer, but you're an entrepreneur as well. You created a startup, but I also read that you were labeled as a disruptor, as in disruptive technology, disrupting an industry. And that sort of fits in with the who dares wins type thing. Did you revel in that? Do you set out to be a disruptor?
No, not at all. We just set out to make better bikes, and the science was pretty well established. You know, everyone just ignored it because it was a very traditional industry. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the Americans had used aero bikes in the 1980 Olympics. And, you know, pretty much every year after that, and you know, it's like, and you know, my favorite bike was probably the Superbike 2 at the Atlanta Olympics. Absolutely beautiful bike made by GT. Well, it was basically a Skunk Works out of that was badged by GT. There were some GT people in that. Stunningly beautiful bike. And but you know, they didn't win anything because the Italians came out with a Superman position. So they had nowhere near as good a bike as the Americans, but the position of the rider trumped the position or trumped the aerodynamics of the frame, which is, you know, that's the way it should be. It was a way to make everyone faster. So, but it was a time we were just getting started, and you know, the Superbike or the Superman position and all those positions that that the Italians pioneered, and then your countrymen also did some really great work on as well. So Graham Mulberry there. So yeah, it's just like it was a bunch of neat stuff that came out in that era.
I'm looking at that Superbike. No top tube, just like a step through frame.
Yeah. Wow. I just love the aesthetics, the balance of all the proportions on it. I think it's just stunningly beautiful. And with a disc, and then the way it hugs the frame, and the way the frame's got that kinked seat tube in there. Yeah, I just think that's a stunningly beautiful bike, the way everything's integrated on it as well.
Interesting that the wheel size is a different there. There was a trend for a while, wasn't there, in having smaller front wheels on some time trial bikes. But that yep. seemed, and there was also a phase in triathlon, maybe before Cervelo got started. Maybe not when they started having 650 wheels. A lot of the smaller females were riding those as well because did they have a better rolling resistance or lower rolling resistance, but easier to pick up the momentum.
Well, yeah, from that standpoint, I still think it's a good idea. Like if you're small, female or male, you know, it's easier to ride a smaller wheel bike. I mean, just the proportions are also better on it. Like you'd get rid of the toe clip overlap. And, you know, if you're light, you don't have as big a side area to deal with. So I still think they're a good idea, but they've kind of, that whole trend has moved away and everyone's going 700C now. But I still think that you know, especially on the front, a 650C is if your front end is very low, 650C is a good solution. We did some testing years ago, and we took the same bike and we had 700C and 650 on it, two different frames, but they were designed for that. And we found, you know, that it was a round head tube was worse than having a longer round head tube was worse than a bigger wheel. Like so at 650 versus 700C, and you just varied the length of the head tube. If it was a round head tube, you were better with the bigger wheel. However, the question you ask a few years later, and you go, well, if it's not a round head tube, if I can make an aero head tube and a carbon bike, which is better? And then the answer is the reverse. A 650C front wheel is actually faster because you have a nice aero head tube above that doesn't really have much drag at all. So what I find kind of funny is as the market evolved and we could make everything in carbon and the frames got much more aero, suddenly we actually went away from the best solution, which I think was probably a 650C front.
So, I mean, seems like cycling design is quite cyclical. And, you know, we touched on this before about when you've had so many innovations and we've arrived at a certain point now, how do you keep doing new things to sell bikes? Does that mean that instead of doing new things, we just go back to older things and make them better?
Yeah, I think we should go back to wooden rims and solid tires. That's the next new thing. Mark my words.
No doubt somebody will say that this is the latest fad, but do you understand what I mean? Is this how much more opportunity for development is there in the bike? And would we then go back to people looking at the 650B in order to create more, you know, more bikes to sell? Because you've got to keep, you know, like designing new cars, you've got to design new things. Otherwise, people aren't going to buy new bikes, are they? So what are we going to entice people with in the future if we've covered everything?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, that's kind of a cynical way to look at it. And there are people that, you know, feel it we try and do that in the industry. We just kind of reinvent something. But realistically, I mean, you can say that with big tires. I mean, everyone, you know, when you and I started riding in probably the 70s, you know, the minimum tire was probably a 32 or something. And then it went down to a 17 on race bikes. Mm. And now where are we back to? We're back to the average tire on a race bike is a 25. I think probably the normal bike that almost, or the normal tire size that everything's sold with is a 28. And I know, you know, all the manufacturers are going to bigger and bigger. So they're sizing bikes for the future to be even larger tire sizes. Wow. So we're going right back where we came. We started 30 or 50 years ago.
So what you're saying, Phil, is instead of 28s, I mean, I've just got 28 tubeless on my road bike, which is like riding. It's like riding a sofa. It's so comfortable, particularly on some of the British roads, which get a little bumpy. Is it likely we'll be seeing 32s on road bikes in the near future, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's some point where the all the wheel makers have now adapted the designs of the deep dish aero wheels to work well with larger tires. And I think, you know, I'm quite a fan of the head Vanquish line. Works really well with everything from a 23 to a 28. So I think that's going to be the norm. As you get larger, you've got to redesign the wheels. Otherwise, they don't work well with a tire that's bulging off of them. So 28 is kind of the norm now. I think that might be kind of where we kind of stabilize that. If you're riding, you know, on gravel or that sort of thing, you're going to probably want more than a bigger, want a larger than a 28. And it's not going to be quite as aero, perhaps, unless someone starts making really wide rims that work for 32 and 35 millimeter tires from an aerodynamic standpoint. But 28s are still a huge improvement over. I took my wife out and on a trail ride one time on her bike that's got her old bike that has 650C, you know, deep dish rim, 650C, and she's on like a 23 or something, and she's like just completely sinking in. And I'm on a 28, and it's just like just floating on top. Hmm. So that didn't go very well. So we're in the market now for getting her a new gravel bike because she liked the gravel, just didn't like riding it on an old 23 millimeter tire. So I think the 28 is kind of a sweet spot for my road race bike, but you know it's bigger than that for sure if you're riding gravel.
I saw a discussion. We talked about slow twitch, and Dan always has some good articles on there. I think this was written by Jordan Rapp, and he was talking about 700C wheels versus is it 650B?
And having different. Yeah, 650B is the C is the old road race thing, and the B is the new kind of mountain bike size. Yep.
Okay, so that's not quite a 27-inch wheel. Then it's 26. Is it really?
No, they're pretty much almost exactly 650B, a large 650B, and a 700C are more or less the same. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I wasn't entirely sure of what the difference was in terms of the actual diameter of the wheel and tire when she'd got it on, or whether there is really any significant noticeable difference.
Yeah, if you put a large tire in a 650 and a smaller tire in a 700, more or less work out the same. So.
So that would for a gravel bike then. That 650B would allow a larger tire to fit in the same frame, and yep. That would give you more comfort off-road.
Yeah, and you've got this. I think that's a really neat area to go into. Is like it's a one bike that does it all, and you can just swap your wheel sets, and you can ride off-road. You know, on things that you know you would have considered that it was mountain bike territory. Well, that's quite easy to do on a gravel bike.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I mean. That's probably the route I've gone down in the last few years. I got rid of my, I had a 26 incher, so they went out of fashion as everybody started using 29ers. But they're less maneuverable around some of the tighter forests that we have in the UK for sure. So I got rid of that mountain bike, got myself a cyclocross bike, which I guess it's probably a bit more popular cyclocross in the UK and Europe than it is in the US. We don't have extensive gravel trails like you do out there, but I suppose essentially the same thing. But I found that riding that is a bit like riding my mountain bike that I had 25 years ago when it was a hard tail and narrow tires and required a bit more skill to get over certain bumpy sections than you perhaps require now. But I just have two sets of wheels, a road set and a set with some knobbly tires on for going off-road, and it's the perfect combination. I only need one bike now, which somehow goes against the whole cyclist N equals or N plus one type of rule.
Well, from a purely industry standpoint, we've managed to sell you a new bike that's the same as the bike you had 20 years ago. So would you still buy another bike, though?
yeah, absolutely.
Our evil plans are working.
Well, you just told me that was a cynical question, and now you're telling me that that's how it actually is. Did you have much design in bikes and cycling before you started Cervelo?
No, I liked riding, and you know, I just used to live on the edge of town, and I used to just take my bike and go riding off into the country, typically alone, and just go riding. I just really enjoyed it on kind of any road. So we've gone got kind of. We're circled full coming back to the bike that used to be all roads. You rode it down the farmer's lanes, you rode it on trails, and you rode it on the road. It's like, it's kind of like that. But I wasn't really a designer. I was a designer from the standpoint of, from an engineer, and going through engineering school. And I liked that. And I was really in the project management side of things when I went back to McGill and met Gerard. But I people said to me one time, like, are you a designer or an engineer? And I thought about it, and it's like, yeah, I think I'm really a designer, because I think a designer really has to understand how it's used and look at the customer and look how they're using it. Whereas an engineer typically, doesn't really do that. They maybe handed a brief and said, just design this. But I think I said earlier, like, any really good engineer should be a designer in my books. They should look at it and understand how the customer is using it. And that's when you get something that's really good engineering or really good design, is when you can anticipate those needs of the customer and go, that guy's having a problem using that. How do I solve that right now before he even is asking the question and getting frustrated?
Mm. That will bring us back to our question that we were talking about before about gearing and gears. Because that's, like you, I drive along or ride along and see people pedaling uphill in the biggest gear they've got, trying to, either that or they're doing some leg strength training, but they're cranking out 40 or 50 RPMs. I'm like, why don't you just change gear? It would be a lot easier. But maybe they don't have the technical understanding of a bike to shift the derailleurs. And, the old Sturmey Archer thing you used to have, which was a sequential hub-based thing with a bit of cable. Seem to work okay. I've seen some of the suggested solutions of these almost like a fan belt type of chain.
Mm-hmm.
There was that ceramic speed whole thing with the rotating.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
With the rotor and the huge cassette on the back, which looks pretty interesting. But I wonder how many of those have actually got legs to make it to mass market.
Yeah, the ceramic speed is super. They were searching for the ultimate solution on very, very low transmission losses, and so it's quite complex as a result of that. But I think there's a huge opportunity to take that concept and take it down a notch and make it more directed towards city bikes. I mean, there are a couple of different Taiwanese and Chinese companies that make shaft drives for city bikes. I've got one of them. It's pretty lossy. Like, it's not terribly efficient. Bevel gears are not the most efficient solution. But the ceramic speed solution takes care of that. Eliminates the bevel gears. So I think the shaft drive, it's clean. You don't have to worry about getting on and getting your pants dirty or whatever you're wearing. The chain doesn't fall off. It doesn't squeak. It doesn't need oil. I mean, the chain is really not a great solution for the everyday rider. It may be super efficient for road racing, but you don't need a road racing solution to get downtown to commute to your meetings or to work. So I think that the belt drive is brilliant. It takes no maintenance. It's never dirty. It never falls off. I love it. I have one that with an 8-speed internal gear hub. That's the ultimate solution for most people. And you still have to change gears, but you could automate that. You know, Shimano's done that. There's a couple of other companies that do automatic gear changing. You could certainly do that. There's no reason that you couldn't have, you know, an automatic shifting mechanism that would work just fine, and, you know, controlled electronically, and it would shift, you know, when it's totally convenient for you. So I think that they've been expensive solutions, but they don't need to be. Like, the cost of electronics now, and this is one reason that I think Four Eyes has great potential, is we're a bunch of tech guys that love to ride bikes. So it's a good mix. It's not just a tech company. It's bike people that have a tech background. Mm-hmm. And electronics are so cheap now. Memory costs nothing. Communication costs nothing. The electronics cost nothing. We can, it's not a matter of, can we do it technically? It's, we can do anything we want technically. It's, what does the customer need? And how do we solve those customer problems? And, you know, we're in the position where we can actually do that. Or maybe not solve everything, everyone's problems, but we can make some big gains on that and partner with people that want to do that.
Let's just go back to that first bike you designed in 1995. I'll put a link to it because it's a fantastic looking bike. And it does look spookily like the P5X. Now, the P5X, if I'm right in thinking, would have been once you'd sold the company, was that right? But you were still there. So you would have had some involvement in that bike.
Yeah, Jordan and I, we focused on the front end of innovation. So we would go out and we would look at where we thought technology was going and where we thought the sport was going, what customers needed. And we would kind of define those ideas, and then we would kind of pass that concept document to the engineers, and they would take it from there. So we had this the standard line. We had the P, the R, the S line, and we had an I line, which just coded for I. And we said I is illegal, and you can do anything you want. So make the fastest bike possible, and there's no rules. And that's a big mandate. So it was like, it was just tossed to the engineers and say, you guys figure out what the fastest bike is. And so it was a long, long process, but we started that, several years before we left, and it went through several iterations and eventually came up with that. So, I was a little surprised. We had moved out of the company when they finally kind of got that prototype down and decided to go down that direction. And I was a little surprised about that, to be honest. You know, they took it to heart, did a lot of testing, and some smart guys, as they looked at it and they said, we have to understand what our customer is and how our customer behaves, which is what Gerard and I had typically done. But by us leaving, they were forced to figure it out. And so they said, well, let's go to races and watch how people use the bikes, which is exactly what they should have done. And they came to us and they said, well, the question was, how many bottles do people carry, and what do they typically carry on their bike? So probably carry a spare, maybe a folded up tubular, and probably a flat fixing kit. And they said, they said to me after they'd done the research, and I said, what do you think people carry? And I went, well, they probably carry two water bottles, and then probably a flat kit. They said, what percentage of people carry that? And I went, oh, it's probably 80%. And they said, and how many different versions of that would you think they're out there? And I said, oh, there's probably three or four different ways people carry it. They said, there's no standard way that they carry it. There's like 140 different solutions. Mm-hmm. And the biggest number, you think there'd be an 80-20, like a Pareto rule, like 80% of people would carry two bottles and a flat kit. Seemed logical to me. They said, no. The biggest number of people that carried a particular configuration was like 15%. Wow. So there was no standardization at all, which took them down the road of saying, okay, everyone likes their own different particular personalized solution. So that bike then became not a best way to integrate two bottles and a flat kit, but it was a solution, or the mandate was, how do you build the bike that anyone can fit up the best way they want for themselves? So it comes down to many times, I think, asking the right question. And the engineers did a phenomenally good job of reframing the question when they came to develop that bike. So you don't see all that work where they set up remote cameras at like a bunch of different triathlons, Hawaii, I think they went to Germany, and they did a bunch of them in North America. And every time a bike went by, it took a photograph. And then they came up with some algorithm to measure what the combination of equipment carried on the bike was. So they didn't have to go through, I think they had 14 or 15,000 photographs to figure out what people were actually using. So, I mean, I thought that was a great case of engineers being really, really good designers, because they really had to go back to the design phase, the front end of innovation, and frame the question properly, and then answer all those questions before you started the design.
So it was just a coincidence then it looked like that bike, that first design. There was nobody that went back through the annals and thought, "Wow, this is quite a sexy looking bike, and can we make it like this?"
I think there was, and I mean that there was the aero. There was a lot of work on different aero configurations, and they went back and forth a lot on trying to figure out what the best way to go was. So I know that you know that probably played into the aero questions, but it did have storage in that kind of in the spoon or the shovel at the front. I mean there was storage in there as well. Mm. So, but it was difficult to make, and you saw how that kind of the shovel kind of evolved itself out of the design as it went on to subsequent evolutions.
So when I was reading, prior to our conversation, I read somewhere that you'd said that your goal was to instill your values in Cervelo to the extent that the company can run without you. You compared the situation to the design and manufacture of the bikes, tasks that you once completed personally, but now carried out by a team that you'd put together, and having built the bikes that established a company, you now focused on building the team that will sustain it. So what you've just described with the way they built that P5X sounds like you could probably have sat back in your chair and gone, "Do you know what? I've done a bloody good job here, because that is exactly what I wanted to happen."
Yeah, like people, yes, I think they did a great job. And yes, that's exactly how I would have hoped to see it play out. Now, it doesn't mean it happened immediately. It wasn't like they just brilliantly did it. They struggled a bit and they went through a period of time trying to figure it out. But yeah, I think the best thing that we did at Cervelo, Gerard and I, we didn't have a best design. We had a best culture. We built the culture that was that allowed them to carry themselves forward and build great bikes. And they internalized what that meant. And I didn't realize that until we left, just how strong that culture was and how much we'd done on that. You know, it wasn't really until the guys at Pond said, "Okay, figure out what you guys did at Cervelo, and can you help us innovate in the other areas?" that we figured out, oh, you know, it's all built on that culture. So you build the culture and everything. That's the foundation of a good brand, and everything. If you've built the foundation right, building the house is the easy part. Mm. Or maybe not the easy part, but the part that's it's built on a solid foundation. It's never going to come down.
You mentioned earlier about how they became very good at asking the right questions, but I guess that's part of the job of a mentor, isn't it? Is not to show people how to do it, but just to ask them the right questions about doing it, and get them then to figure it out for themselves.
Yeah, and it's, you know, that's a challenge, I think, as you grow up and as you have a company, you start out in the founder phase in the startup, and you're making all the decisions. And the company goes through stages, and one of those, well, several of those stages involve you stepping back and not telling people what to do. And it's really hard to do that. You got to shut up, you know, and ask them what they think. And and then if you really think that they're going down the wrong path, you keep asking. I think the way people talk about it is the five whys. Like, why are you doing that? 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 Until you really get down to the crux of it. So yeah, you've got to be able to do that. And you've got to take out your involvement where you're telling people what to do. And that's tough, because you've built the company by direction and telling people where to go and what to do. And then you've got to take yourself out of that. So that's the reason that there are tough transitions in the evolution of every company, because you have to change your management style as it goes through. And yeah, that's brutal. It's really hard to do. Changing your behavior is super hard.
I mean, I don't have children, but I guess being a parent is very similar.
Yeah, I don't have a kids either. So it's like, but yeah, I see that. It's like, you could argue it's the same. I think maybe that's a little bit demeaning to your staff to talk about them as children. But
yeah, but
I mean, yeah, that's there was a great line that was on someone's fridge that had kids, and they said, there's only two things you can give your kids. One is roots and the other wings. And that is the best thing you could do for a company is roots is really the culture, and wings is, okay, now go do yourself. And really, I mean, I think we did some things well at Cervello and some things we could have done a way better. But I mean, we certainly did without really understanding how important it is. And without, you know, a conscious thing is we built a culture, or we helped the employees build the culture there. And I mean, really, you don't define the culture. Your employees define the culture. You just set the guidelines and help them do it. And you do that by hiring the right people.
So you'd have to use a Henry Ford analogy there in when you're hiring people, is to hire slow and fire fast, I guess.
Yeah, and hire people that share your values. I mean, and if you see they don't carry those values through, you've got to get rid of them. So, yeah.
We were just talking about children there. You founded Cervello, you sold Cervello, and then in 2017 you left. So that, how hard was it to leave behind the baby? The thing that you'd grown and developed?
It was hard because, you know, you go through cycles of being really annoyed about what's happening and then kind of going, I'm not there anymore. And so you have to just kind of disengage, but it's cyclical. And then you, over time, you go, it's no problem there. Especially when you see them on the wrong path, then you get really frustrated and you want to jump in. But after a while, you see them kind of doing the right thing, and you go, that makes you feel better as well. So it wasn't, you know, you think, well, I left and, you know, it was an easy transition. I don't think it's ever an easy transition when you move into a new role, you know, in a less involved role in a company for anybody.
Well, let's move on. You're at 4i now. You joined a couple of months ago. What were you doing in the interim then, that from when you left Cervello in 2017 to now? Because that's a couple of years at least.
Well, there was those years doing as the chief innovation officer across the pond bike companies. And that was a great opportunity for me to try and figure out, okay, what did we do right? What did we do wrong? And how do we, you know, transition that innovation culture to other companies? And one of the big things I did find was this company called Eureka Ranch, where their business model was basically training you to innovate. And they had a process or a system of innovation, and they wanted to basically teach you to implement this in your own company. And that was kind of unique because that's what we were looking for at Pawn was, you know, we couldn't afford to hire IDEO to come in and help us as the project managers on every new project, because all we did was projects. So we had to train ourselves to be great at doing innovation projects. And most companies' business model is built around, yeah, I'm happy to come into you, in for you, and I only charge $450,000 per project. And it's like, yeah, that doesn't really work for us in the bike industry because all we do is bike projects and we don't make $450,000 on any project. So this whole Eureka Ranch and innovation engineering is a great solution for that. It's a really well thought out system that kind of built on what was done at Procter & Gamble many years. And now it was implemented initially at the University of Maine as a minor in innovation. And it's really now taught at about 25 US, I think actually some continental universities as well. So you can get a minor in innovation and they've got the process worked out for you. So it's much easier than, you know, developing and implementing your own innovation system. It's like, why not, you know, take what's already been out there, been well proven, and it's a well-oiled machine, and just particularize it for your particular company. Like, there's some things you'll want to focus on, some things you'll bring in new, some things you'll de-emphasize, but it's a really good system. So I was doing some consulting work on innovation, was acting as a mentor to a few companies and acting on the board of a few others. And so been helping out a few small companies where I think they have a tremendously good idea and that sort of thing. And that's where I got involved in this company doing these wheels. It would be, how do we make this wheel that's much more resistant to gusts? So how do you have it so it's always sailing, it's always generating thrust, and you're not getting blown around on the course. So things like that I think are really fun. And I did a bunch of work on electronics and how do we improve the experience of a rider, without making it complex. You can put all this complex tech on it, but that doesn't make it better. That just makes it a complex thing done with tech on a bike that's very simple. So I think that 4Eyes has a real potential to do that. So that was kind of what got me involved with them a couple of years ago. And eventually I came in the board, and then, you know, with COVID, the boards in a lot of companies were taking a far more involved, becoming far more involved in operations and finding investment and making sure the company was stable and well-positioned. And so I was asked to come in and help out a little bit with them there.
Okay, so let's run through what the you mentioned earlier, that there were three main areas that 4Eyes are involved with. So do you want to run through those and give us a little bit more?
Yeah, I think they've for a while they started out making, like, the 4Eyes name came from glasses, and they would have a section of LEDs, so you could program the LEDs to, you know, give you feedback on, okay, you are in the training zone, where's your heart rate going, that sort of feedback, so help you in training and racing. Probably before its time, good idea. You're seeing more and more evidence of people trying to come up with alternate ways of presenting information to you, other than, you know, just a heads up display than a display. But, you know, that was their first foray into the sport tech field. Then it was heart rate monitors. And the neat thing about their heart rate monitor is it's super accurate. It's actually really good to monitor heart rate variance, which you as a coach know that a lot of coaches are using that now for an understanding of training stress. But also it's so good that they found that they're selling a lot to medical rehab. So for people that have post-cardiac events or post-cardiac surgery, we're selling a lot of them into that segment as well. It's just like, hey, we didn't know that there was an opportunity there, but it's like sometimes fate deals you really nice hands. So that was nice. It's a very accurate thing. And it also has an ANT and Bluetooth bridge. So you can collect data from your bike and then transition. Like if you've got your power meter or whatever, and only transition ANT, you can transmit it through the heart rate monitor to your computer if you're running Zwift or something like that. So kind of unique having an ANT and Bluetooth bridge as well as memory. So you never, even if you're riding along and your Garmin goes dead, you know, you still won't lose that data because it's stored in the heart rate monitor. So heart rate monitors and then the power meter. I mean, we've really focused on building a super accurate heart rate monitor. It actually reads in three dimensions. So it's a 3D strain gauge. And you're going, well, why bother with that? Well, it's like, if you look at it, everyone's pedaling style is different. And some people are really, really different. Some people are kind of more traditional. But if you're more of a stomper, a lot of the strain gauges that are based on cranks won't actually pick up accurately your power. So the neat thing about this 3D strain gauge is that it picks up anyone's pedaling style, and it works for all pedaling styles. So that's a kind of a neat. And we've tested it in real world conditions. No, not just hooking it up to an electric motor, but Dr. Cram at the University of Colorado, we've actually had real people ride it, and we can accurately measure what the performance is versus a lot of other people are just putting them on a motor to basically simulate it. So I think it's a super accurate device that's and it's really inexpensive. We really focused on bringing it out and making it so it's anyone can get into it. So if you're just getting into using power, you're a young person that's just earlier in your career, and you don't have to buy a $3,000 power meter. You can buy one of our power meters starting at $299, and bang, you're already into, you know, much higher level of quality of training.
Is this the one that's a left sided only, or is it the one that's got the left side and the dual option?
Yeah, you can do both. Like the $299 one is the left side only.
Mm. There's always, I know there's always a little bit of a debate about where the left side is just doubling up the power on the left and whether it's really accurately measuring what's happening with the right leg.
Yeah, most people have a slight, or most people are generally pretty balanced. And depending on the day or how you're riding that day, you'll have a slight imbalance. But not many people are hugely out of balance. So usually a single-sided power meter is a pretty good estimate. If you really want to get, you know, the accuracy of double-sided, we do have that option as well. It's a few more dollars, but I mean, and you can just buy, you know, buy that and you've still got, you know, the left side compared to a new right side as well. So yeah.
I just know from particularly when we've got riders who are doing long rides, if they have got an imbalance, they tend to lose that balance of power a little bit later on in the ride. And that's probably when you'd want to be knowing about it more, because if you're a triathlete, that's going to affect your running.
Yes.
But okay, so you've got the heart rate. Now the heart rate monitors, do they come with a watch or is it just a chest strap? And if it's a chest strap, does it match up with the most, you know, the most popular variants like Suunto and Garmin and Polar that are on the market?
Yeah, we focused on instead of trying to build a kind of a wall around our ecosystem, is making it an open system that anyone can use with. So all of the tools we have, whether it's a power meter or the smart trainer or the heart rate monitor, can hook up to pretty much anyone's solution. So it's like, yeah, we haven't tried to build a wall around our own system.
You're not doing a Steve Jobs then and making it a completely closed network.
No, I mean, and it's like, I think that, you know, I think what we're trying to do, and we're thinking in the future, and we see it really as an open system is the way to go. So I think as we develop more things in the smart or in the tech side, in the smart sport tech side of it, I think there's more value in making it, you know, adoptable. Everyone can design their own system then, and it's not, you know, not hooked into one system and only one system.
Mm. You've got some indoor trainers as well, I think.
Yeah, we've got this, what we call the Flight. And the neat thing there is it's quite inexpensive, but it's totally silent. So you've got the noise from your own drivetrain. But I've got a couple of friends here in town that, you know, live in an apartment building or live in a house with a bunch of other people. And, you know, before that, the vibration that's set up by your heart rate or by your heart rate monitor, the vibration that's set up by your trainer, like it's tending to get the whole house shaking and your neighbors are hating it. This thing is quiet. So like the trainer itself emits essentially no noise at all. And so you don't get, you know, the vibrations transmitted to the walls and the ceiling and below and everything else. So it's done really well from that standpoint. We've got a lot of people in these COVID times that have been, you know, saying, hey, this is great because I can train all day in the middle of the day and my neighbors aren't killing me.
I know all about the noise and the vibration thing. I used to be the UK distributor for CompuTrainer for until they went bust a few years ago, and that was one of the quietest products on the market. It still had some noise, but that was one of our selling points over the competition. Then was, you know, it's much quieter. So if you're living in one of those city centre apartments, all you need to do is put a little bit of a rubber mat underneath it, and you'll kill out most of the vibration and noise. It was a lot more expensive than the product, so we had to, but it was more accurate. So a good example of a company that thought it was at the head of the market and took their eye off the competition, really.
So I
totally get that one. So you know, triathletes love innovation. They love, as you've talked about with the Cervelo bikes, triathletes will, if they think it's going to give them an extra second or an extra watt, they're interested in opening the wallet and getting the credit card out. So given the majority of our listeners are triathletes, apart from the products that you've mentioned already, what do you have coming up in the future that you can talk about that might be of interest to them?
Well, I think that I've got some stuff coming up in the future, but I can't really talk about it. So, I mean, but I think you can see, you know, when we talk about power meters, I mean, people are talking now about, you know, the nice thing is they're getting affordable, so everyone can access it. And that is, you know, what we see as a significant benefit, but also like the ability to train indoors and out. And we're finding that there's a big bump now in power meters. People are looking for, they've been stuck inside on their trainer, and they would now want to get a power meter to continue their training on the outside, but they're looking for something that's inexpensive. So I do think that, you know, there's value in in the democratization of power. Everyone's understanding that, hey, I'm really learning something from this power. I'm learning how to ride better, and I'm getting stronger. So we are seeing, you know, a real push down market on power meter pricing and demand. That's kind of getting into the fitness and leisure bikes. Like the whole COVID thing has really, in North America at least, we've seen the sub-$1,000 bike has been the big seller. Mm. You know, some brands are actually not doing better than normal under COVID, and some are doing spectacularly well, but it's really contained in the lower level price points. So how do we get those people that have bought a $1,000 bike, how do we get them into the whole cycling ecosystem and the whole culture, and how do we get them moving up into that? So I think there's a real market for less expensive solutions on power, and we'll continue to look into those. But I think an open system, how do we do that, and how do we integrate things so you're learning more from your rides? I think that's a real opportunity as well. So we're looking at kind of those sort of things. How do we do it? And also, you know, how do you make a Zwift platform now that doesn't require you to get a super expensive trainer? I mean, combination of your heart rate monitor and your power meter on a bike, it's a relatively small investment. You can use it indoors and out. And then you've got, you know, that's a really inexpensive Zwift solution. So that's something that I think people are starting to look for, especially as you can't get a trainer now. They're looking for a solution like that.
Yeah, trainers and cheap bikes under $1,000 just sold out everywhere, aren't they?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So, well, Phil, it's been fantastic. I'm, you know, it didn't occur to me to think about the history of Cervelo and how these products come about. But I'm glad we hooked up with this call, because it's been a really interesting insight into your journey and people who disrupt an industry, a well-established industry, a traditional industry like cycling was. So congratulations to you for doing that and creating a product that people do like. So you've satisfied your goal there, really. I think is listening to and understanding what the customer wanted, and clearly they still like and want that product, because that's why it's at the top of the rankings every year.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I think that's should be the goal of a designer, is to, you know, anticipate those unarticulated needs of the customer long before they can even articulate them. You've solved them, and so that's the real trick, and that comes from talking to your customer and listening to them, and not just thinking about your own ride, but watching your customer. So I think we've had fun doing that, and hopefully we build a better product as a result of it.
I'm just thinking about that lesson there about listening to your customers and asking the right questions. There's certainly a few companies and industries that come to mind with their performance during the coronavirus outbreak that could do with some mentoring on that particular subject.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, listen, Phil, thanks very much for being on the show. Really appreciate it. It's been a great conversation. So thanks for taking the time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Best wishes at 4i. And when you've got those new products out that you can't talk about now, let us know, and we can have a chat about them when it's out in the open.
Okay. Will do. Thanks a lot, Simon. It's great to chat with you.
Best wishes to Phil. Thanks very much. Bye-bye for now.
Cheers.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.